saying hello. Fania, we're very happy to have you here and welcome to all the audience to the penultimate event in our online series, The Hamas-Israel War and Antisemitism Facts and Discussion, which is organized by Thomas Hinz and myself, Petra Quintini, at University of Konstanz in cooperation with Tel Aviv University. As today I saw that by the emails that there are several new participants, I would briefly explain why Thomas and I decided to organize this event series. So it has basically two reasons. One, it was because we wanted to show solidarity with colleagues and friends and people in Israel and all over the world after the terrible massacres of October 7th. And then we felt the need to react to the almost simultaneous rise of the anti-Semitism, which also had to lead to numerous aggressions here in Germany as well, also at universities, and which obviously has a massive impact to Jewish life also here in Germany, all over the world. And we see that many, that there are very highly emotional debates and many of them use a lot of anti-Semitic narratives. And so our idea was that maybe this is also due to a lack of knowledge, and we wanted to counter this with expert knowledge and create an opportunity to for exchange and also for dialogue. So before I briefly introduce Fania today, just a quick note for the audience. We are holding this this event in webinar form. So please, if you have questions, use the Q&A session, which you find in the basic line. And like all previous events, this event also will be recorded. So it will be available within some days on our website. Yes, today it's my pleasure to introduce Fania Ort-Salzberger. I'm very happy that you are here because I think you are really an important voice of Israel. And you are a historian and a writer and a very, very important voice for peace in the Middle East. And I think for you have been working or trying to work for peace since about 50 years, I guess. And yeah, unlike our previous guests from Israel, you are not a professor at Tel Aviv University, but you are a graduate from Tel Aviv University, and an emeritus professor from Haifa University. So as an Israeli historian, you have been researching on the European Enlightenment and the story of political thought. As I said, you were a professor of Haifa University. You were raised in a kibbutz, in Kibbutz Hulda, and you also served as a young girl as an officer at the IDF. And after your graduation at Tel Aviv University, you went to Oxford University for your PhD. You also have an honorary doctorate from Uppsala University, and you had several fellowships and professorships at several universities all over the world, also at the Wissenschaftskolleg zu Berlin, at Princeton University, at the Monash University in Melbourne, and at the Ludwig Maximilians University at Munich, and much more. You have been awarded the German Federal Republic's Order of Service in 2020 and also the Grimm Prize in 2021. You're the author of numerous academic articles, but also of some books. One of these, Jews and Words, you co-authored with your father, the famous writer and peace worker Amos Oz. And you regularly write on international newspapers, mainly on topics of Zionism or modern Zionism, and also for the two-state solution. And yeah, let me add just one phrase more, because you are something, or you define yourself, and I think this is very interesting, as a humanist Zionist. So your lecture today is about Israeli-German dialogue after 7 October and the Gaza War. And in your title, you name the concern of this series of events. So this is perfect. Thank you, Fania, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Petra. Thank you, Petra and Thomas, for the invitation. I'm very glad to be here. I am seldom glad these days because these are very hard times, and I was personally not directly bereaved, thank goodness, but many good friends were bereaved in the most horrible ways. On the 7th of October. I'm not an objective or a neutral player here, but I will try to be reasonable and analytic because that today is a civic duty that many people neglect. My title is made of three words, if you like, German-Israeli, or rather Israeli-German, because I come from the Israeli-German dialogue. But if I could expand it to six words, it would be we desperately need an Israeli-German dialogue now. And it's not quite happening. So as I look at the German press, at opinions pages, at arguments, books already, and reviews and conversations among friends of Israel in Germany, and not only friends of Israel, I realize that what's going on and what must be looking very big and dramatic to you is simply unknown in Israel today. It is, of course, unfortunately, well known that Israelis right now are unable to listen to almost anything, let alone intellectual arguments within the Federal Republic of Germany. But this is not new. There were many inner debates, domestic inflagrations of disagreement, very interesting ones, ever since the historical Streit in the 1980s that Israelis did not quite follow, or follow belatedly, or a very, very small minority of intellectuals and students, academics maybe, but a very thin line. It never really passed. It came to it that even the speech of then President Richard von Weizsäcker at the Bundestag in 1985, commemorating 40 years from the Second World War and the Shoah, in which he pledged the Federal Republic's everlasting, not guilt, but responsibility to remembering the past. And by extension to the Jews and the Israelis, even that did not really echo in Israel. About 12 years ago, I arranged to have it edited and published by Wrestling in Tel Aviv. That was the first time it even appeared in Hebrew, alongside with an important essay by Habermas. I was trying quite desperately to sound certain voices from Germany here. And vice versa, and it's not always working. And when I look at the cluster of the debate in Germany in recent months, I'm almost glad it's not working, that Israelis are not exposed to it right now, because it is the wrong debate. And it is not a dialogue, even though some Israelis are representing themselves there. And speaking and airing interesting and legitimate opinions, these opinions do not stand for any part of the Israeli public or civil society or sphere of discussion within Israel. And I'm here tonight to urge you, all of you and beyond, to open lines of conversations with the broad, moderate, part of Israeli society with moderate Zionists such as myself and quite a few others, obviously. With people such as my late father has been, who have worked for both German-Israeli dialogue and Palestinian-Israeli dialogue for many years based upon the Zionist model. It is a Zionist model, not only, it's also a humane model, it's also a liberal model, it's also, in my mind, an ethical model of the two states, Israel and Palestine, side by side, so-called the two-states solution. What I find when I look at the German debates post the 7th of October is, firstly, there was the rush of empathy, of course, and adrenaline. And then came the backlash, and the backlash is with us, and it's going to be with us for a very long time. So I come across what I consider a very dangerous and unjustified conjunction of two different issues or topics, maybe three. One of these topics is the so-called fetishization of the Jew. I understand that is the title of the book, or philosemitism gone mad, or a sense of protecting the Jews and the state of the Jews at all costs, silencing other voices, several such expressions of what I deem a legitimate point. Entangled with what I deem the illegitimate, or at least very scary, neighboring argument that Germany should abandon its culture of remembrance, that Germany should abandon, that the Federal Republic should abandon the legacy of Richard von Weizsäcker, and more recently, Angela Merkel with regard to the state of Israel, and earlier Willy Brandt with regard to the Jews, Konrad Adenauer on his visit to see Ben Gurion in Israel in the 1960s, that the whole setup of remembering the Holocaust ought to be abandoned in favor of a more neutral, more globalist, perhaps, cooler, analytic, rationalist view of the Middle East. And I'm all for an analytic and rationalist view of the Middle East. I try to do it myself in days that are emotionally very difficult. But liberating German identity from its responsibility for maintaining Holocaust remembrance? Is this really what is needed post the 7th of October? Last night, I sat in Vienna on a podium with an Israeli historian, not living in Israel, Professor Omer Bartov, fellow historian, also originally from the University of Tel Aviv. And he said that Germany's 17% or so of newer citizens, of recent immigrants, will not feel fully German until Germany had let go of its Holocaust remembrance identity, of that part of the bedrock of the Federal Republic. And I shuddered, because I fear to think what would become of Germany and of Germany's more recent immigrants and their children if this particular legacy is abandoned. In my mind, it has nothing to do with the question of whether an overflowing philosemitism has blinded the eyes of German policymakers. Because that might be possible, that might be true. For many years, when my father was visiting Germany often, and so was I, also lived in Germany for a while, we had discussions about the overflowing love, admiration, if you like, for Jews, especially Jews of cultural orientations, too much love, too little critique. We felt it, we talked about it, we critiqued the fact that there is still such a hypersensitivity instead of a good, solid human face-to-face conversation. when the new Jewish Museum in Berlin, designed by Daniel Libeskind, was founded in the late 90s, early 2000s. I went with my father to have a visit. My father said, "To me, the building is absolutely amazing, but it doesn't belong to anything and it looks like a broken spaceship." And I said, "Father, what do you mean?" And he said, "It looks as though the German Jews had been some travelers from outer space that had landed one day in Germany, and it ended with a terrible crash, and this crash is being commemorated in the building. But it's nothing to do with the real people who were there." I think it's a slightly brusque critique of the building, and this is not our main topic, but I shared the feeling that sometimes, and I will be a little blunt about it, as a Jew and an Israeli, coming with my own work to Germany, talking to German audiences, I felt a vibe of being, symbolically, of course, as a representative of a certain group, not quite human, but maybe higher than human, which automatically means also lower than human. Somebody to be cherished in a way that does not promote criticism. For years, I have been arguing that we need a critical friendship from our friends abroad, including and especially Germany and the United States. More recently, under the Netanyahu governments, which I am a staunch opposition, I argued that we need tough love. I say it even all the more so right now, as what is unfolding in front of our eyes after the 7th of October, after that calamity, disaster, in my mind also genocide of the western, northwestern Negev residents, of whom 10% perished or were abducted by Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and Gazan citizens. All the more so when this just war lost its bearings and became an unjust war due to the policy of the Netanyahu government and specifically Netanyahu himself. My call for help is not meant at those who saw Israel as some kind as a holy grail of humankind and a wonderful country which can't go wrong in the good old social democratic days, perhaps in the days of Ben Gurion and the early Labour Party, and now are saying, "Oh, this is quite the opposite. It has become corrupted to the point of being satanic." This kind of extremism has not helped. Neither the philo Israel nor the anti-Israel. No. I am aiming my word at people who are willing to be tough and critical friends, in other words, true friends. And this is totally built on a culture of remembrance, of remembering the Holocaust, of keeping a sense of responsibility, not guilt, as Weizsäcker rightly discerned. And responsibility in this new generation, I think not even responsibility for the Holocaust, but for keeping the flame of memory going. On the other side, and this I've also been saying for years, and it's very hard to say things for years and now to see them slap you in the face because they went unheeded. On the other hand, weaponizing the Holocaust by Israeli politicians is a very bad idea, which has recently turned disastrous. Because ever since, I think it was Menachem Begin, who was the very first in this huge fallout with the Chancellor, with Chancellor Schmidt in the early 1980s, started waving the Holocaust in the face of the German government as an argument in the discussion. Things were going from bad to worse ever since that time. Because especially right-wing nationalist politicians, unlike the Labour Zionist legacy, have been using what is now fashionably called the victim card by waving the Holocaust when Israel was asked to do difficult things for its own sake, such as talk to the Palestinians, such as sitting down to a territorial negotiation and agreement. The Holocaust as some kind of an alibi for not moving towards Israeli-Arab peace. It was not part of labor Zionism's legacy. Zionism did not step on the global stage in the late 19th century, in the early 20th century, as a victims organization, but as a group of Jews who decided to shape their own history, but also as a group of Jews who decided to come back to the bosom of the family of nations by diplomacy, by pragmatism, by making the best of difficult situations, and by keeping strong friends abroad. This was the rock bed of early mainstream labor Zionism and liberal Zionism, and the saner parts of right-wing Zionism too. Fast forward to Yitzhak Rabin. Yitzhak Rabin did not use the Holocaust to try to negotiate a better deal vis-a-vis the Palestinians in Oslo. He tried to negotiate a pragmatic deal with the Palestinians in Oslo. And he might have succeeded had he not been murdered by Yigal Amir on the 4th of November, 1995. The kind of Zionism I come from has never intended to become a helpless victim, either in Europe or in the land of Israel. Nor has it intended to use victimhood, when that became a possibility, in order to wrench the world's heart into concessions to hypernationalism. This is not what my Zionism, my grandparents' Zionism, my parents' Zionism was all about. And I would like to say a few things about, you've already mentioned it, Petra, about humanist Zionism, as I call it. Others have called it a moderate or pragmatic or liberal Zionism. All these names overlap to some degree. Because this will lead me to the two states solution and to the kind of conversations that ought to take place with a significant chunk of Israeli society today. Both Theodor Herzl and in his way David Ben-Gurion, and certainly the people who wrote and rewrote and edited and signed Israel's Declaration of Independence in May 1948, belonged to the broad mainstream between liberal, more in the direction of Herzl, and social democratic in the direction of Ben-Gurion, that acknowledged from the very start the existence of Arab people living in the land of Israel under the Ottomans, then under the British, and strove to reach a just cohabitation with them. Initially, for many years, since that was no country, it was part of the Ottoman Empire, the idea was to create a state for the Jews and all its citizens, Jews or non-Jews, equally. State of the Jews, the Judenstaat, Herzl's title, not at all accidental that it is the state of the Jews and not the Jewish state. There was no mystical or halachic element in this. It was nothing specifically transcendent about having a Jewish, so-called Jewish state. It's a state among others in the world that happens to be the nation state of the Jews and being a liberal democracy of all its citizens. This is Herzl's Altneuland. This is Israel's Declaration of Independence. And this is the part of Israeli society, the growing part, from a handful immediately after the victory of 1967, when we conquered the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and the Golan Heights, and euphoria skyrocketed. Only a handful said we should retreat as soon as possible. We should let the Palestinians have the same right, universal right, that we have been claiming of a national home or state for themselves. This handful grew significantly by the late 80s, and it was a strong, albeit opposition power in Israel's civil society of the 80s and the 90s, until Rabin won by a comfortable majority and put this to action in the Oslo Accords. Tragically, after the assassination of Rabin, neither Ehud Barak, nor Ehud Olmert, nor the great promise Tzipi Livni, who did not even become prime minister, were able to navigate us back to that humanist Zionist track of having two states next to each other, of keeping Israel strictly a liberal democracy with equal rights, ongoing equal rights to its own non-Jewish citizens. That was the idea. It doesn't take a brain surgery to understand this pack, this package of hope for the future. The rise of Netanyahu and Netanyahuism, or as we call it for short, Bibism, involved several elements. I will be very quick about them. Sociological changes in Israel, the growth of the ultra-Orthodox and the ultra-nationalists for reasons of demography, large families, strict, very strict education. Having the youth grow into ultra-nationalism or ultra-orthodoxy from an early age without any exit sign. And on the other hand, the weakness of the left, unable to develop, to raise a charismatic leader, he or she, who could counteract Netanyahu. But it was only in Netanyahu's more recent years, when he got entangled in corruption allegations, not allegations, but indictments, three cases of major corruption, that he decided to turn his back even on his relatively moderate centrist coalition partners and create Israel's most extreme right government in November 2022, under 2 years ago, when Israel's disaster began in earnest. It is exceedingly Zionist, as I have said before, to battle for a smaller Israel, not the river to sea of our ultranationalists, but the smaller Israel that would maintain itself within its internationally recognized borders, the truce borders of 1949, after the independence war from our perspective, and the Nakba from the Palestinian perspective. It is utterly Zionist to wish for this smaller Israel to be liberal, democratic, and at peace with a neighboring Palestine, within the borders of the occupied territories of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, give or take mutually agreed corrections and amendments. It is still possible. It is in my mind, especially post the 7th of October, the only bloodless horizon that we Israelis and Palestinians have. The only way to go about it without shedding more blood. So, what is wrong with the one-state solution? Immediately after the 7th of October, some people said the two-state solution is dead. Nobody will want Hamas as next-door neighbors if they continue to rule Gaza. And I said that I think it is the one state nation. That is that. Because even I, after the 7th of October, many others like me, and we are not the left who left the left. We are not the disillusioned. We are not ex-peaceniks who are saying, like some are saying, we have to give up the dream of peace with the Arabs altogether. No, we are the ones, and there are many of us, because the Israeli left is not dead, and the Israeli peace camp is not dead, who are saying we cannot live in one state with Hamas warriors, with Islamic Jihad terrorists, and with the many thousands of Gazan civilians who cheered them, or the West Bank civilians who cheered them. Of course, these civilians deserve and deserved much more protection than they received in the ongoing war in Gaza. The fact that they cheered or did not cheer Hamas is not relevant to their human rights. Yes, I have to say, to make it clear. However, I would not like such people, the rapists and the mutilators and the mass murderers and the sadistic torturers and their cheerers, to be my fellow citizens in my future country, in the future Israel, or in a non-Israel state that will probably be called Palestine. This must not happen to me or to my children. I can live with these people, perhaps to begin with in very cold neighborhood, in a two-state solution. How many Israelis am I speaking for? I can't tell you. There was no poll about the question, do you feel emotionally able, capable of living in one country or in two countries with the murderers from Gaza? There are no such polls. But I think that I am speaking for a significant chunk of moderate Israelis. In the demonstrations against the government, which are going strong and stronger by the week, in Tel Aviv, Haifa, Jerusalem, and the over 40 other locations up and down the country. Of course, we have combined messages being free the hostages, of course, end the war, or at least end it temporarily, stop starving Gazan civilians, that's also there, and increasingly more, back to the Jewish-Arab conundrum. There will be no solution before we end the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza. All this admixture is there. But there are no calls, such as you hear even from certain Israeli intellectuals abroad, to abolish the state of Israel, or to undo the idea of a state for the Jews and all its citizens. And very few Israelis, there are such, but very few, are still pining for the one state solution. However, in Germany, these voices are very strong. You hear Professor Omri Boehm, you hear Professor Dan Diner, and others busily advocating for a one state, obviously secular and liberal, in which peace and love will rule, in which not remembrance but forgetfulness would be an excellent idea. The Israelis must forget, maybe the Palestinians must forget, and all live happily ever after. I am a skeptic. As my father used to say, I have to bring him in again because this conversation belongs to him too somehow. As he used to say, make peace, not love. We are not in the business of love or even friendship, not in this generation, not in the next. Maybe later, yes. Later, maybe there could be some kind of a confederation, one state, the United Middle East, United States of the Middle East. I'm not against it. I'm not enslaved to the idea of a nation state for the Jews, which is what Zionism is about. Not at any foreseeable time in the future. Right now, which is still the era of nation states, of states protecting their own sovereignty and security, I would not like to be the one going back to square one, to the 2000 years of non-sovereignty, non-statehood, and absence of protection of my forebears. Let somebody else start that. We need a nation state for the Jews, fully liberal democratic, otherwise I would not stay here, I will not live here. And we need a next door, hopefully democratic or at least moderate Palestine with good protection between them. Maybe a wall with all the dark connotations of a wall for a generation. Robert Frost, wood fences, tall fences make good neighbors. For a while, until we can move on, until we can become friendly neighbors. But not right now. The trauma is too great on both sides. I would like to ask you, and I'm wrapping up, to listen as much as you can to moderate Israelis, to those who are Zionists, because the overwhelming majority of Israeli Jews are Zionists, define themselves so. The minority who are not are mostly the ultra-Orthodox. And because this Zionism need not be the monster it has become in the social media as a result of propaganda. At the same time, of course, our own propaganda machine, the Netanyahu propaganda machine, is not something that I'm representing or speaking for. Help us to get rid of this bad government as soon as possible, legally and democratically, of course. Not by force, not by undue international intervention, but help us, because we are getting there. There is still an Israel of the kind that some of you may remember. It's gone under the wheels of Israel's constitutional flaws and some moral flaws. The assassination of Rabin has been a history changer. The rise of the charismatic, increasingly populist, and recently criminal Netanyahu is a historical failure. We are still just about able to elect a far better government and to begin amending the faults. We need your help. Please listen to us. And I'm, of course, very happy to answer questions, counter arguments, skepticism, and perhaps even optimism. Who knows? Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Fania. And again, to all the audience, the questions. So the put please your questions in our Q&A session. So that we can read them out and Fania can answer them. So Fania, I think you also can read it, but I don't know if all the audience can read this question. Professor Mitchell Ash has a question here. He says that Dan Dinair recently published an article in the FAZ in which he said that a solution will only be possible when both peoples acknowledge that millions of Jews and millions of Palestinians now live in this territory who were born there and therefore have the right to stay there. Do you agree? By the way, in this article, Dan did not advocate any specific one or two state solution.
Well, yes, thank you for the question. I've not read the article. I'm going to rely on your abstract of it. I think this circumvents the big question on which the existence, the right of Israel to exist, would stand or fall, whether by acknowledging the Palestinians who were born on the territory, we also mean returning them to the exact same home that their great-grandparents left or were forced out of during the Nakba. Because if that is the case, we are already on the side of river to sea and of Palestine, yes, Israel, no. Oh, the one-state solution, which amounts in my mind to the same thing. So no, it will not be enough for millions to acknowledge, because we'll have to go for the nitty-gritty of the question, what about a right of return? Where will the future Palestine be? And this is where we will enter into an argument.
Okay, thank you. So there's another question of Michael Onan. Wouldn't there be peace immediately if the Palestinians arrive at three fundamental convictions for the Israel-Palestine conflict to get solved? First, we recognize the equal right of the Jewish people to self-determination in their historical homeland in Israel. Second, we aspire to create a Palestinian state neighboring and not instead of the Jewish state. And third, we recognize that we are not refugees and that we do not have a right of return to Israel.
Well, the easy answer is, of course, yes. The more difficult answer is that exactly like the previous question, which was about agreeing or acknowledging that everybody was born there, that everyone is indigenous, we are not there. I mean, it's a very, very distant utopia to assume that this might take place. You know, my intention in this talk was to say, let's approach the moderates on the ground, reach out to Israeli moderates who already exist, even if they do not represent the exact same horizon that you are aiming for. Reach out, much more importantly, to moderate Palestinians who might exist. Yes. But of course, if a Palestinian leadership said that, it would be the end of the line for Netanyahu as a dependent for his political survival on the ultra-nationalists. But it will also, I think, reveal a significant, not to say vast, majority of Israelis willing to take this point and to accept that and to reach peace based upon them, compared to the minority of ultra-nationalists, the Ben-Gvirs and the Smotrichers, who would rather die than accept this kind of peace. So yes, if we reach these utopian moments, things will be well, because there is, maybe I should say, there is still an Israeli majority for such developments. But we need to start with what we have. And what we have is about 3 million moderate, mostly Zionist Israeli Jews, 2 million Israeli Arabs who are showing very impressive civil responsibility these days, in what is a very hard time for them, but they will be out there to support a coalition, a viable coalition, who would undertake, even if not calling it peace right away, because for me, peace with Yahya Sinwar and his troops is, even to a peacenik, it sounds terrible, but not with Hamas, with an alternative to Hamas, the Palestinian Authority, or what will inherit the Palestinian Authority. Yes, we can still get a majority to get going on a territorial, or as they call it now, a regional agreement. Enter Saudi Arabia and the moderate Arab regimes, not democratic, I'm not mad about the regimes, but moderate, and international Western powers, and this is still doable. So these are the Israelis you want to talk to. And as to a horizon, of course, both questions have given us a possible horizon to hope for.
So isn't the right shift in Israel a reaction to Palestinian rejectionism?
Yes, the answer is partially yes. Partially yes. There was a disappointment in the immediate aftermath of the Oslo Accord, by the way, on both sides, because there was terrorist activity on both sides, but far worse from the Palestinian side, as it happened, the Second Intifada. But this is only part of our shift towards the right and then towards extreme right. Other parts have to do with the horrible historical accidents, not really accidental, of the assassination of Rabin and the rise of Netanyahu as Israel's first in my mind and many others, anti-Zionist leader, ruthless anti-Zionist leader who is leading us to an abyss.
I'm fully sympathetic with your optimism, and it's important to keep it. And nevertheless, there are so many questions that are popping up. For example, you asked us to be critical friends, and one of these points to that comes into mind is what happens with the settler movement in Israel. So from my perspective, so I was sometimes to Israel and I saw the society, and not all of it, of course, but I get some insights. And what I could not understand as a critical friend was that the Israeli politics and the government tolerates in a way these settlers in the West Bank. Yeah. And I mean, this is something that is so, it seems to be so clear that this is not the right way to live in peace with your neighbors, yeah, or to come to a more peaceful future. And as long as it seems to be no way to change the Israeli politics in the way that they accept that the West Bank is now the territory of maybe a future Palestinian state. Yeah, but as long as the settler movement is tolerated or supported to some degree, even by politics in Israel, it stays very complicated.
I couldn't agree more. I celebrated my 17th birthday. I will not tell you how long ago, demonstrating on a bare hill in Samaria, in the north of the West Bank, outside one of the first settlements ever built. And I've been demonstrating against them ever since. There was a sense during the Oslo process in the 1990s that we were getting there. And of course, the Oslo agreement incorporated the dissolution of quite a few settlements, not all of them. And by the way, maybe not all of them will have to be dissolved if some agreement, mutually pleasing agreement, is reached. But I have no doubt in my mind, and that's part of my political and ideological ticket, that most of these settlements will have to be disbanded. And moreover, what is happening now in the recent years with the violence of settlers on the ground, and that started way before the 7th of October, but came to a pitch after this latest government was elected, and Smotrich and Ben-Gvir started openly, jeeringly, with self-satisfactory smiles on their faces, to allow settlers to behave like soldiers and far worse than soldiers. So I couldn't make it clearer that I'm totally against this phenomenon, that it is bad not only for peace with the Palestinians, but for the future of Israeli democracy. And it's going from bad to worse. And this is part of what we will have to fix, to mend, when we manage to elect a moderate government.
Mm-hmm.
It's already a promise made by several of the leaders, like Yair Golan, the new leader of Labor. It's already on the table.
Would you agree that critical friends of Israel would need to put more pressure on your government in these respects? So now Annalena Baerbock is now in Israel, or was in Israel, and she tried to do something. And some of the European states even recognized Palestine as a state recently. So is this something that helps you as critical friends, or do we need much
yes,
more
well, you know,
serious
much
things?
Much depends on timing and context. I am in principle in favor of recognizing Palestine internationally as a possibly helpful step, but to do it in the aftermath of the 7th of October by countries like Spain, who were anti-Israel almost from the first moment, when there was still more Jewish blood on the ground than Palestinian ground. Then, you know, the timing is, I keep preaching for pragmatism here. So you need to be pragmatic. But what your foreign minister has said in Israel is very resounding and very important. And I think that the German government is entitled and should consider castigating Netanyahu or sanctioning the Netanyahu government even more than it does now, but all while recognizing and emphasizing publicly that the civil society of Israel is not an enemy of peace. And that ideas of, for example, BDS or the boycott of academic and cultural institutions, you know, this has been going on for years every now and again, and now it's reaching a tide. And there are many, many incidents also in Germany. And this is the most foolish thing that can be done. This is not the South Africa situation for many good reasons. And the cultural and academic Israeli institute, the large majority of them, are on the side of peace, are on the side of moderation. So be careful what you do. And please give us the grace of discerning, of distinguishing between government and civil society.
No, we have other questions now. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's Manuel Boruta from Konstanz University. Thank you so much. I have two questions. First, where do you see a German tendency towards an abandonment of the remembrance of the Holocaust, except among the extreme right? Is it not rather a question of supplementing the German culture of remembrance with the remembrance of the genocide in Namibia, the remembrance of the Armenians, in which German military personnel was also involved, and maybe even a reflection about the indirect German responsibility for the Nachbar? And second, how realistic is the prospect of a peaceful Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank in view of the high number of Israeli settlers?
Okay, two very good questions. I will try to be brief. First of all, of course, I fully agree, and I have nothing against and everything for the remembrance of other instances of genocide, especially those in which Germany was directly or indirectly involved. I am saying that there are intellectuals from the left who are claiming that the remembrance of the Holocaust as a feature of Germany's, of the Federal Republic's very nature, very foundation, should go away, should be diminished because it is not very friendly towards the new, mainly Muslim immigrants. And I've heard it from several intellectuals. I will not name names at this point. I think that people know, and this is for me a very scary, very frightening idea. As to the second question, how realistic is the prospect of peace with the settlers' population being as strong as it is? Yes, it is strong, as it will be. Very bad. I hope not as bad as a civil war. It all depends on the Israeli leader who would be able to sort it out, and on the Palestinian leader who could promise us a real peace and stability for the future. So both the drive and the attraction should be stronger. And you have to remember that among the hundreds of thousands of settlers, about 600,000, many are not the idealistic hardcore. Many are people who went there for cheap and good quality of life or good air, unaware or morally ignorant or blind to their Palestinian neighbors. By the way, there are also settlers who are not blind to the Palestinian neighbors, who are in relationships with them and friendships with them, and even talk together in groups about possible solutions that would leave both people in place. So there are all sorts of strange birds there. But I and my part of Israeli society is willing to face the enormous crisis, and it will be an enormous crisis, of evacuating the settlements, as we should.
Okay, so there's Fabian Thiel. He says, I absolutely see your argument for a two-state solution as the one that provides security for Jews living in Israel. This argument ultimately stands or falls with the successful securing of the border to a hopefully peaceful Palestinian neighbor. Perhaps the somewhat pessimistic question, is it realistic to secure this border in such a way that it can actually withstand attacks like the ones we have seen?
Yes, thank you for the question. The short answer is yes, it is possible, and it ought to have been possible to secure the border from the kind of attack of 7th of October. There were many military and some policy mistakes and faults that created this horrible combination of circumstances. Of course, the policy mistakes, also by Netanyahu himself, were the most gruesome, but there were on the ground military failures. So yes, it is possible. There will also need to be a demilitarization of the future Palestine during an interim stage. And de-radicalization, as I often say, of both sides, but not least of the Islamist part of the formula. And yes, Palestine will have to be demilitarized for a while because I'm a peacenik, not a suicide. We'll have to do it and then hopefully come to a full normality in the fullness of time.
So I continue with a question of Lotem Halevi. Thank you for your talk. My question is more of a personal one. I am an Israeli Jewish social scientist, left of you and not necessarily moderate. But I broadly study nationalism, Zionism, and anti-Semitism in 19th century and Central Europe. I have always considered myself a Zionist, yet somehow since October 7th, my history and identity have been hijacked. At what point do words like Zionism lose their meaning when they have been appropriated by those greater numbers when we qualify them as adjectives? Who are we talking to in the diaspora? In the diaspora, if the antecedents of our discussion differ, how can we create and share a balanced narrative that squares together the histories told by the new and old historians of this Israel?
Lotem, I will have to start a new lecture, and I can't, so I will only give a partial answer. What you cannot afford to lose, you must reclaim. And there are some things we cannot afford to lose. As you may know, the protest movement in Israel reclaimed the Israeli flag, the national anthem, Hatikva, and the Declaration of Independence, which is on our side anyway, for the pro-democracy protests of last year. Before that, the flag was used and abused mostly by right-wingers. We reclaimed the flags. We sing the national anthem because it is an anthem full of hope and gentleness, although it will have to be amended to accommodate Arab citizens at some point. And the Declaration of Independence is an epitome of humanist Zionism. So since 6 out of 7 million Israelis here in this country and any number of Jews and non-Jews abroad insist on being Zionist, that is, simply believing in the right of the Jews to have their democratic nation state in part of the ancestral homeland, we need to reclaim Zionism, both from its Israeli ultra-right abductors and from its anti-Israeli abductors on the other side who equate it with Nazism. We need to reclaim Zionism for us. And I think, again, for us moderates, if I may include you in this. As to nationalism and socialism, I just recommend my rather recent article on Isaiah Berlin. It's online, Isaiah Berlin on nationalism and Zionism, showing that there were two kinds of nationalism, a bad kind and a better kind, and that Zionism mostly tended towards the moderate kind, the benign and not the malign nationalism of the 19th century. And then we can continue arguing, obviously. I would be delighted.
Dieter Rübeck, he asks, do you agree that there is needing a third party to bring the process of negotiating between Palestinians and Israel forward a bit? Dan Dina talked about it a few weeks ago.
Well, yes, we certainly need the world party. I've been equating this to, excuse me, it's not a very educational metaphor or image, but one of those betting machines in Las Vegas where you need to get three cherries in a row in order to win some whatever coins. I've never tried. Three cherries in a row. One cherry is a strong and brave Israeli leader. Second cherry is a strong and even braver Palestinian leader. And the third cherry is a powerful, hands-on intervention by the international community. And more specifically now, when I talk about the immediate future of Gaza, what would allow Israel to retreat and still to maintain a sense of safety is some kind of an alliance involving perhaps the European Union, perhaps NATO, the Americans, other Western countries on their own accord, and certainly moderate Arab regimes, headed possibly by Saudi Arabia, to be on the ground in Gaza. I'm not giving formulas and recipes, to be on the ground in Gaza in order to make sure that a transitional government there, hopefully the same government as the West Bank, as a preparation for a future Palestinian state, can stand on its feet and become viable all the way during the de-radicalization of Palestinians, including the educational system. I did not mention the United Nations because, unfortunately, after having looked very deeply into many accounts, I deem the United Nations a part of the problem, to put it very mildly. Not to mention UNRWA and the kind of education that Palestinian youngsters have received in schools supported by UNRWA and the United Nations, and unwittingly by Germany and many other Western countries all those years. So, yes, the third party is the world, and we've already had one cherry, two cherries. We never had three cherries. We need the three cherries. So, the global intervention will need to be hands-on in order for the situation to be resolved.
Thank you. So here's again Professor Mitchell Ash. It is common to say that Netanyahu was forced to accept the radicals in order to form a coalition and keep himself in power and out of jail. Might another few be possible, which would remind us that he was an annexationist in his youth and never renounced that position? Could it therefore be that he has exactly the coalition he wants?
You know, we historians often argue about Bismarck, whether Bismarck had an ideology of some kind or whether he was the ultimate talented Machiavellian who just moved and caught the wind as it blew past him and took opportunities. With regard to Netanyahu, for many years he was considered to be a mild hawk, but a reasonable, rational human being. Not anymore. I think that he has deteriorated into something that is not even a hawkish, ultra-nationalist, a full big Israel ideology, but something that only a playwright or a great author can recognize, a certain corruption of the human soul. I know it's not a typical expression in academic seminars, but here you are. I think that we are talking about the gradual, and we have been watching him very closely, him and his family, a gradual corruption of the soul leading to a wholly, I can't say Machiavellian because Machiavelli is much better than that, but to a wholly cynical, nihilist view of the world, the region, history, Jewish history, and the well-being of the state of Israel. It is a mode of survival alone. It is scary to watch, and it has historical precedents. Maybe I can say something, if I may, Petra, just to as a few parting lines, if you still have the
Yes,
patience.
absolutely. Absolutely.
As you have probably heard echoing from my words, there is a strong interconnection between what we call the juridical reform, but it's not a reform, it's a coup d'etat that this government tried to conduct throughout last year, and the calamity of the 7th of October. They are interconnected. A less than democratic regime, a corrupt regime, a one-sided regime cannot defend its people properly. And in our case, unfortunately, the retribution came very, very fast. However, Israel is not alone in this process. We may be what my friend Diana Pinto has called the canary in the mineshaft. We are the first hit by this combination of ultra-nationalist, racist, populist, social media-leaning, lying kind of campaigning. We were the first, and we got it hit by it very powerfully, but we are not the last. And many countries that I could mention here, including some very close to everybody's hearts here, stand a similar danger, with maybe less of a security danger as Israel to its cost has faced. But you say you face the same danger. So what we need to do, what we are hoping to do over here, and now I'm being perhaps overly optimistic, but maybe just usefully and pragmatically optimistic, we want to show the way out of the rise of fanaticism on all ends. We want to show the way back to the moderate, which is never exactly the middle, never exactly the middle. You know, I'm not just a moderate, I'm a social democrat, I'm a liberal, I'm a humanist. Not the exact electoral middle, but self-conscious moderates. And in our part of the world, hopefully to live to see the peace of the moderates taking place. So I wish this upon us and upon all of you facing extremists and fanatics on your own turf. Good luck to us.